68, when they started to do this exhortation, I didn't know where it was going to go. And I had a lot of problems in the end, but anyway, it's about parables. Sometimes in the Bible it's obvious when a parable is read and when real events are real events. Sometimes a reader can easily distinguish between things to be taken literally and things that are not literal. They're figured. Not always so simple. Many times when Jesus spoke in parables, people misunderstood him. And sometimes they took him literally. A good example of that would be Jesus once said when visiting the temple, "You'll destroy this temple and I'll raise it again in 3 days." Of course, those listening all thought he was speaking literally about the real temple and objected. They said, "Oh, look, it's taken 46 years to build this temple and you're going to raise it in 3 days?" Yet the gospel writer notes that the temple he had spoken of course, his body. In other words, he was talking figuratively in a kind of parable. And even Jesus' own disciples from time to time were confused by his figurative speech and parables. But for example, on one occasion he told his disciples to be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. And they misunderstood, thinking that he was reproaching them for having forgotten to buy the bread. And then he explained to them, he was talking figuratively. The yeast was the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now it's easy to smile at the mistakes by the people of Jesus' day and forget that we are reading the account, including the explanation. Without the explanation, we would probably be just as confused as those to whom Jesus first spoke the words. And we've got a unique story, a unique parable in the story of the rich man of Nazareth. One of the best known in the Bible because it's got several unique ways of expressing itself. Firstly, it is unique because although its style resembles a parable, and also it comes immediately after a series of 4 other parables, you had the lost sheep, the lost coin, the prodigal son, and the dishonest manager. It certainly is not a usual parable. The parables of Jesus normally concern nature, everyday life, customs and society, not starting with visions of the underworld complete with fire and chasms and all that sort of thing. And secondly, this parable, if we can call it a parable, is the only one with real people. We have Abraham and Lazarus, and they have both names. Thirdly, it's unique because in the teaching of this story, it clearly contradicts the rest of the Bible's teaching about what happens after death. For example, no other support can be found anywhere in the Bible for the idea that souls live on after death, or that souls of good and wicked go to different places. And then finally, Jesus uses various phrases such as the bosom of Abraham, and images such as the chasm separating the underworld in two, which are only found outside the Bible. In fact, these terms are only found in first century Jewish mythology. So the pictures of the afterlife in the Bible, the pictures of the afterlife given in the story of the rich man and Lazarus contradicts the Bible to a certain extent. Something that is even stranger, given the popularity of Luke 16 in the churches, it's given as a proof of text on heaven and hell, is that it contradicts church traditions. Because if Abraham is really a place where one can communicate across a chasm with the wicked, burning in another part of the underworld, then he's certainly not in heaven, is he? Luke 16 clearly has nothing to do with a popular picture of heaven. But some churches have attempted to get around this by saying, the bosom of Abraham was just under the earth when Jesus spoke, but he's now in heaven. Apart from the lack of any Bible support for such an idea, what exactly does this achieve? we're going to understand Luke 16, that parable, we have to do some context in the rest of the Bible. But first, it is worth noting that the parables of the New Testament are not simple stories like the fairy stories that you tell children. They can be, and were intended to be, difficult to understand for some. And two quotes come to mind there, Matthew 13, verse 30. Therefore I speak to them in parables, because seeing they do not see, and hearing they do not hear, nor do they understand. Verse 14. And in them the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled, which says, hearing you will hear, and shall not understand, and seeing you will see, and not perceive. And then there's another quote in John 16. These things have I spoken to you in figurative language. But the time is coming when I will no longer speak to you in figurative language, but I will tell you plainly about the Father. So God requires us to seek, to use our brains, and then he'll open our eyes to the truth. Jesus told his disciples in Matthew chapter 10, Behold, I send you out, he sent them out to preach the truth. Behold, I send you out as sheep in the midst of wolves. Therefore be wise as servants and harmless as doves. In 1 Corinthians 14 verse 20 he says, Brethren, do not be children in understanding, but in understanding be mature. Well, some parables are quite easy to understand, aren't they? Because we are told what they mean. For instance, the parable of the weeds in Matthew 13 goes, there's a parable about a farmer who finds weeds growing in his field, isn't it? The interesting thing about this parable is that it's one of the very few where Jesus later does explain the meanings to his disciples. We know the sower was Christ, the field, the world, the good seed, God's people, the bad seed, bad people, the enemy, the devil, the reapers, the angels, the harvest, the end of the age. So there's no confusion there at all, is there? But when we turn to the parables in Luke which lead up to that of the rich man of Nazareth, Jesus tells us a parable about a man sending out invitations to a feast. But the invited guests are too busy with business to accept the invitation. The host becomes angry and says, well, invite the poor and outsiders instead. It's easy to see the characters in the parable are all real people, or groups of people. The host of the banquet, of course, is God. The servant sent to call the guests is Christ. The guests who make the excuses are the rich Jews. The poor and the sick of the town, the poor Jews. And those from outside the town, the Gentiles. Also was based on real life circumstances. When he told this parable, Jesus was actually present at a banquet. You see chapter 14 and verse 1. And his audience included exactly the kind of people who were excluded in the parable. In Luke 15 and verse 11 to 16 we have the parable of the lost son. You'll remember that one very well probably. The young son who took his inheritance, spent it all, ended up eating with the pigs, and then realised what an idiot he was. And he returned to his father and so on. At the end, the father says he was dead and is alive again, lost and now found. That's quite an easy one to understand, isn't it? The father's God, the older son is a Jew, the younger son is a Gentile. Again, real people and local circumstances. Next parable in Luke 16, which we read this morning, it's the parable of the dishonest manager. This is one that those who heard it did not follow it at all. It's often misread today. Jesus clarified it though in verse 14 where he said, The Pharisees who loved money heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. Jesus said to them, You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others. But God knows your hearts. Saying that the master is God, the dishonest manager is the Pharisees, and the debtors the people. Instead of the bills being literal money owed to God, the Pharisees were reducing what the people owed to God in terms of worship and righteousness. As it says in verse 17, it's easier for heaven and earth to disappear than for the least stroke of a pen to drop out of the law. And then verse 18, Jesus had in mind the Pharisees' practice of selling divorce letters when he says, anyone who divorces his wife and marries another woman commits adultery. The man who marries a divorced woman commits adultery also. So again, the parable is real about people, local problems, contemporary issues. And now we'll turn back to the rich man and Lazarus. This is the last parable in Luke 16, and the one I've sort of been building up to. First thing, that there is no break between verse 15, where Jesus says, you are the ones, meaning the Pharisees. So in verse 19 of Luke 16, it would suggest that the Pharisees are the audience of this parable as well. So who are the characters? We have the rich man, his father, five brothers, Lazarus, and Abraham. So where do we start at the place? It seems easier to start where there's likely to be the most agreement. Well, we know that Abraham is the Abraham of Genesis. That's pretty well set in concrete. The next easiest is Lazarus. There's only one person with this name found in the Bible, namely Lazarus of Bethany. He was a brother of Mary and Martha who was raised from the dead by Jesus and John. In comparing parallel accounts of the anointing in Bethany and John and Matthew, we find that Lazarus' other name was Simon, that he'd been a leper. The leprosy must have been healed when Christ raised Lazarus from the dead, but he was still known as Simon the leper. This explains why the Lazarus in the parable was full of sores. The begging had nothing to do with poverty. It was because he was unclean. Because according to the law, Simon would have been ceremonially unclean and could not enter his own house. For we know that in Leviticus it says he must live outside the camp. So we have these two men, they're both Jews, both called Lazarus, both beggars, both lepers, both of whom died, and both of whom would not convince people by their resurrection. So the coincidences all point to the fact that it's one person. So now we've got Abraham and we've got Lazarus. Now this leads us to, of course, the rich man. That's also known to be in the audience of the parable. Reading the story, we can find the clues to the identity of the rich man. He was rich, of course, verse 19. He dressed in purple and fine linen, verse 19. He lived in luxury every day, verse 19. In his lifetime, he received good things, verse 25. He had five brothers, verse 28. They lived in his father's house, verse 27. They had Moses and the prophets, verse 25, but they didn't listen to him, verse 29, and they would not be convinced even if someone were to rise from the dead, verse 31. It's not obvious to the modern reader who the rich man is, but it should be clear that the picture is much too detailed simply to be a representative of all rich men. The Pharisees who were listening would have known immediately whom he was referring to. There was not any chance of their mistaking it, because only one man in Israel dressed in purple and fine linen, a man who fitted exactly all the clues which Jesus gave us as to the identity of the rich man, lies in the Old Testament. In Exodus 28 we find the instructions given to Aaron for making the high priest's garment, blue, purple, scarlet yarn and fine linen. The The Pharisees could not fail to understand that the man dressed in purple and in fine linen was the Jewish high priest. The high priest, when Jesus spoke this parable, was Caiaphas. We know from the Jewish historian Josephus, who wrote a detailed account of the period in the antiquity of the Jews, that Caiaphas met all of the four first qualifications of the rich man. He was rich, he dressed in purple and fine linen, he lived in luxury every day, in his lifetime he received good things. In Luke 3 and in Acts 4, we meet the other high priest who served with Caiaphas, Annas, who was father-in-law to Caiaphas. Josephus also records that Caiaphas served as a high priest from 18 to 35 AD at the time of Jesus' ministry. Annas had been removed from his office by the Romans for openly resisting them. But behind the scenes, he retained his authority and his position. This is why in John 18, Jesus is tried first by Annas and only afterwards sent to Caiaphas. And then Caiaphas, not Annas, sent Jesus to Pilate. The five brothers-in-laws Christ mentioned are the five other high priests who, in fact, his five brother-in-laws, the five sons of Annas, and this is from the historian Josephus. They were Eleazar, 16 to 17 AD, Jonathan, 36 to 37 AD, Theophilus, 37 to 41 AD, Matthias, 41 to 43 AD, and Annas the younger, 62 AD. So now we have established all the identities involved, what does a parable actually mean? Today there are many different theories about death. Some think that when they die they go to heaven, and St. Peter will be at the pearly gates and greet them. But in the times that Jesus lived, the Pharisees believed that the dead went to sit in the lap of Abraham. Now that's not recorded in the Bible, but there is a reference into the Apocalypse which says, in 4 Maccabees 13 verse 17, where it says, "After our death in this fashion, Abraham, Isaac and Jacob will receive us and all our forefathers will praise us." And so that was a popular belief in those days. The parable goes on saying that the rich man was buried in hell and he saw Abraham with Lazarus in his bosom. The word for hell is usually Hades or Gehenna. Hades is the nearest translation in this case, but it's not really relevant. The answer is not in the Bible because it's drawn from myths of the first century. This is recorded in Zephaniah. Now it needs to say that this is not the Zephaniah in the Bible. It's called an apocalypse of Zephaniah, and it had nothing to do with the Zephaniah who wrote in the Bible, who lived with King Josiah about 1620. The so-called apocalypse of Zephaniah, on the other hand, was written by an unknown Jewish author, and probably a Pharisee, sometime around 150 AD. It's interesting, however, because the myth shows us what many Jews in Jesus' day believed. The details are not exactly the same as in Luke 16:23-24. For example, in the apocalypse Zephaniah, the chasm between the fiery part of Hades and the part given to Abraham had a giant river running through it. In fact, the author recounts the fictional Zephaniah's journey across the river in a boat, steered by an angel. But note, the Pharisees did not teach that the righteous went to heaven. Even they knew that no man has ascended into heaven. Heaven was for God alone, and to teach otherwise would have been blasphemy. The Pharisees also did not teach that Abraham's bosom was the final destination of the righteous. The Pharisees taught a resurrection and judgment on earth. Abraham's bosom was just only a sort of a waiting station in a sense. So with the above mind, with all those things in your mind, it's surprising that so many people quote the story of the rich man Lazarus as proof of the doctrine of heaven going. Not only does the story not mention the word heaven once, this description of Abraham's bosom bearing no resemblance to any ideas about heaven taught anywhere. So we've shown that the teaching about Hades and Abraham's bosom is not from the Bible, but from contemporary Jewish superstition. This helps us on the fundamental principle the Bible does not contradict itself, but creates an even bigger problem. Surely Jesus would not approve of false teaching, so why did he say this parable? The answer, well, it's a parable and solves nothing. Even in a parable we would expect consistent teaching. It would have been equally possible for Christ to have told the parable in a way that fits the Old Testament teaching. But Christ certainly did not need to refer to Hades, the great chasm, Abram's bosom, and Father Abraham. So we have to conclude that Christ had a good reason for this. Well, the first reason was they were contradictions of the Jewish myth. The first contradiction was when Zephaniah was able to cross by angelic boat from one side of Hades to another. Jesus contradicts this when he says in verse 26, "A great chasm has been fixed so that those who want to go from here to you cannot, nor can anyone else cross over from there to us." Another contradiction is that in the myth of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob intercede for those in Hades. For the Zephaniah, the Apocrypha, says, "As they looked at all the torments, they called out, praying before the Lord Almighty, saying, 'We pray you on behalf of those who are in all these torments, so you might have mercy on all them.' And when I saw them, I said to the angel who spoke with me, 'Who are they?' He said, 'Those who beseech the Lord are Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob.'" But Jesus contradicts this. Instead, he has Abraham refusing to help relieve the rich man's suffering. In verse 25, it says, "Now he is comforted, and you are in agony." And that's what he states. Another contradiction is that the Jewish myths Abraham is credited with the ability to do what the rich man asks and resurrect the dead. For example, in the first century Jewish fiction, The Testament of Abraham, the patriarch Abraham pleads for the dead and returns 7,000 to the living. But Jesus again contradicts the myth and has Abraham refusing to raise Lazarus. "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them listen," is the statement in verse 29. Jesus deliberately chose to tell a parable drawn from Pharisee superstition. Jesus was showing how wrong their beliefs were. That is why he chose the main characters in the parable to be real people, Caiaphas and Simon of Bethany. According to the Pharisees' view of the universe, Simon is a leper, therefore a sinner, should after his death at Bethany have descended to be tormented in the fiery parts of Hades. Surely. While Caiaphas, on the other hand, was a high priest at the very top of the Jewish hierarchy, be guaranteed a pleasant welcome by Abraham on the other side of the underworld. Well, Jesus told them a version of their teaching which had the beggar, Lazarus, received by Abraham, while the wealthy high priest, clothed in purple and linen, descended into the flames. In addition, Jesus told how the high priest called on Father Abraham to show mercy, and Abraham refused. The mythical ferry boat across the chasm in Hades was not in service, nor was Abraham inclined to help the rich man who had enjoyed such a good life on earth. Then as a final rebuke, Jesus has Caiaphas ask Abraham to send Simon the leper back to the house of Annas in Jerusalem to warn his brother-in-law. But again, Abraham refuses twice. In Luke 16:31, he says, "They will not be convinced even if someone rises from the dead." In this refusal, Christ has Abraham promising Caiaphas the same torment in the fire for his entire household. No wonder then that this is the last of the series of the parables, either presented or addressed to the Pharisees or with the Pharisees present. In the next verse, Luke 17, the Pharisees are gone and Jesus is left alone with his disciples. So conclusions. The parable of the rich man and Lazarus is not as simple as it seems. Some of the keys, purple and fine linen, the beggar covered in sores, the crumbs from the rich man's table, can only be understood by comparison with Old Testament and New Testament passages. The parable contains some details where knowledge of history, the five brothers mentioned by Josephus, or of contemporary beliefs, the bosom of Abraham, can be helpful. Even without these parables, they do not definitely support modern ideas about heaven going. And the parable, of course, can't be literal, because Caiaphas didn't really die and descend to Hades. He was still very much alive in Acts chapter 4, 6. And likewise, also, Abraham refused to raise Lazarus in the parable. In reality, Jesus did raise Lazarus. But Jesus says in John 11:11, that Lazarus slept. He was not literally in Abraham's bosom. And finally, of course, we know that from Hebrews 11:13 that Abraham is not literally presiding over the underworld, is he? He's dead, awaiting the resurrection. There's one only literal thing there about the parable. It's the prophecy of Luke 16:31 that was fulfilled in John 12:10. When Caiaphas and his family tried to kill Lazarus rather than accept the fact that Jesus had raised him from the dead. So ends the parable. I hope you've followed what I've spoken. Now's the time anyway to check our warrant of fitness. Now is the time to serve the Lord. We owe him everything. He's our creator and sustainer. God made you, and he made me. And because of sin, we were isolated from him, and we needed a way back to him. And God, showing his love for you and for me, has bought us with a great price, the life of his Son. So let's each one of us then now remember this wonderful act, the bread and the wine we're about to partake of. Thank you.